order. It's nice to have Senator Limmer back with us. Senator Peterson, if you're ready, we would ask you to go first. I don't see Senator Magnus here yet this morning. Senator Peterson has Senate File 1968, which is modifying the local sales and use tax for the city of St. Cloud, and we have the Waite Park mayor with him as well, and you're very welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Senator Madam Chair and members. We also have a councilwoman from Sartell as well, which is part of this great collaborative effort up in St. Cloud. We have five cities that are working together on this issue. Senate File 1968 addresses an issue of a local option sales tax that is in place right now for actually six cities. I misspoke. It's St. Augusta, St. Cloud, St. Joseph, Sartell, Sauk Rapids, and also includes Waite Park. Members, this legislation would, again, require that each city go to its voters to approve their participation in sales tax and the types of projects that would be funded. So it's important to note that many of the conversations...
I'm sorry to interrupt, Senator Peterson. Can you speak a little louder or pull the microphone even closer? This is the acoustics in this room are really tough.
Got it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This legislation would specifically require a referendum from the community members before this would move forward. But since 2002, this local sales tax has been used to fund numerous projects of regional significance, including the St. Cloud Regional Library, improvements to the St. Cloud Regional Airport, as well as various transportation projects and often capital projects. The joint powers agreement that governs this group is a model of regional cooperation and I believe should be supported. Coming off the St. Cloud City Council myself just less than a year and a half ago, I've seen firsthand the cooperation of these six cities in this region, and we meet on a regular basis and use this joint powers agreement to work together and save taxpayers money across the whole region as we look for opportunities to save those dollars. Extending this sales tax now would allow these communities to engage our residents and allow each city to kind of put together a plan to present this issue as we approach a referendum and work towards continued regional development for a number of these projects. Today, the guests we have to present this case are Mayor Miller from Waite Park and Councilwoman Sarah Nicole to speak in favor of this measure as well. So please welcome them.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, and Madam Chairman, members of the committee. We're here today for support of Senate File 1968. It's a bill for the extension of the existing half-cent regional sales tax that's collected by the six St. Cloud metro area cities, which include Waite Park, Sartell, St. Cloud, St. Joseph, Sauk Rapids, and St. Augusta. The regional sales tax has been in place since 2002 for Sauk Rapids and St. Cloud and St. Augusta, and since 2006 for Waite Park and St. Joseph. Proceeds are shared by all six communities. It's based on how much sales tax is collected in each community and their per capita per population. We're requesting this extension be extended from 2018 to 2038. The reason for the 20-year extension is that most bonds are done on a 20-year basis. And so for us as a region to do a project, we need to have that funding available to us. So that's why we're asking for the 20-year extension. It's allowed us to do a lot of things in our area, not specific to even the Waite Park. It's a regional tax. We do a lot of roads. We've done the St. Cloud Regional Library. We've done the St. Cloud Airport. So that's our major core projects, and it will go to a referendum vote. We're here a little early. You could ask why we're here so early, but we're here because we'd like to take it to our voters with probably the 2014 election, and that would allow us to give our voters a chance to learn about what we're going to do and for them to be well-informed. So I'm going to keep it short with that. If you have any questions for me now, or I will entertain them later.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And Councilwoman Nicole, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm going to be very brief because I think everything's pretty much been hit on, but I just want to stress the uniqueness of our situation, the collaboration between these six cities working together on these different projects. We're simply just asking for an extension of the sales tax that we already have in place, and we have been able to make use of these dollars in an excellent capital improvement projects that have really benefited our entire region, and we just hope to be able to do that in the future. And we're asking for you to extend this half-cent sales tax for us at this time so that we have an opportunity to plan for our future.
Thank you. And members, just a quick comment on Senator Peterson's bill. It's not unprecedented. We did this with Senator Senjum's Rochester bill. They had a sales tax that was extended, and they had the referendum afterwards because they've been having referendums all the way through the process with every adoption and every extension. So this would follow along the lines of what we did in Rochester earlier. I think it was last year. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I hear right that this is for the next 20 years that we're
Senator Peterson.
This?
Yes, Madam Chair, and Senator Limmer, that's what Mayor Miller explained in his testimony.
And Madam Chair, how long is this tax? There's an existing half cent sales tax now. How long has that been in effect?
Since 2002, Senator, Madam Chair, for the cities for St. Cloud, Sauk Rapids, and St. Augusta, because they took it to their referendum vote. And their voters approved it. Way Park took it later at 2006, so Way Park and St. Joseph are from 2006.
Madam Chair, I don't mind cities when they do this, especially when there's the public buying into it. But the concern I have is that what's the best policy for the duration of a half-cent sales tax? 5-6 years, I could see. You get out to 20 years, and I'm beginning to wonder, where the people of that community are making a decision for the next generation of people that are living there and now imposing basically a tax on a future generation. 20 years seems to be rather long. In the days when real estate was on a regular basis, there was an average that people moved from their houses once every 7 years. That would mean in a 20-year period, the population of that community would replace itself three times in 20 years. Now, if that's true, those two subsequent generations of homeowners have nothing to say about the referendum that this generation of homeowners are going to impose on that future homeowner generation and even the next one. So I'm a little concerned about the 20-year life. What's to stop 50-year life or 100-year life? Do you know what your municipal needs are in year 17? I guess I'm wondering, are we really just creating a dependency on a half-cent sales tax and we're so dependent on it that now we're going to write it for 20 years? That's my concern.
Senator Limmer, I'm going to step in here really quick and offer my comments on that, if you don't
sure.
mind. I think 20 years may be a long time, but that's a risk that the local folks are going to be taking, and I think the voters can decide. If 20 years is too long, they're going to get some no votes. But I also think what they're trying to do with these funds is perhaps do capital bonding, build facilities, and the life of those bonds are 20 to 30 years. So they're trying to leverage, in a very straightforward way, a sales tax to pay for regional projects. And I think it's great that the local community is trying to do this for themselves in a regional way. I think if it's too long, they're not going to succeed. And I think they know their community better. And what the voters will support and what they don't. I love the community. I've been up to Sartell, St. Cloud. I don't know what their voters will do. Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I think I understand that concern. But I think the argument can also be for the next generation. Without the 20 years, the dollars may not be available to handle the debt service and actually complete that project. So I think on the other side of that issue, you can make the argument that it is a responsible thing to do. At least the municipality is going to have the dollars to handle the debt service without having to come back on a regular basis and potentially lose the ability to pay that that debt for the next generation as well. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Moore,
these are all really good arguments. And
you've been gone for a couple of days, Senator.
I have. What has become of the Tax Committee? And I'm very familiar with the St. Cloud area. I went to school at State, and the city has certainly been has changed since 1977 when I graduated there. And it's a very thriving community, a very a proud community that has a lot to be proud of. And yet I'm just, it's not a strike against the St. Cloud area. It's just tax policy. How far do we stretch the burden on taxpayers despite the fact that there's a referendum vote? I suppose one could take the logic that says 50 years ago, the good citizens of where I come from, Maple Grove, wanted one, but 50 years later, I'm not sure if that's really pertinent to budgets, pertinent to people's economy, that they we don't know what's going to happen in our economy from 1 year essentially to the next, let alone 20 years, and now we're putting a tax on them. I suppose you could say that, well, we put the little check off that said, well, the public approved it, but I'm not so sure if the public would approve it in 8-9 years. I'm almost thinking that maybe in the future we should consider a limitation on the duration of sales tax, and that it shouldn't go beyond maybe 8 years. But that's I'm not going to bring that up. Just a discussion point.
Other questions or comments for the folks from the St. Cloud area, Waite Park, Sartell? Was there an amendment on this? Senator Peterson, I believe there's an amendment on the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, I apologize. I overlooked that. I was so excited to be first on your agenda, quite frankly. So, members, I need to
kind
offer
of exciting
the,
here.
Yeah, I need to offer the A1 amendment, if I could.
Thank you. We'll have the page hand out the amendment. Do you want to describe the amendment while it's being handed out, Senator Peterson?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. It's really a technical amendment. You'll see it's just consists of really two lines that talks about inserting some paragraphs and then also just a simple date change. So it's a technical amendment just to get the bill in order at, for your consideration.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. As an author's amendment and with the description, I hope members will support the A1 amendment. Any questions or suggestions? Oh. Senator Skoy?
Does a member need to offer that, Madam Chair?
I would think it's an author's amendment, but Senator Skoy, would you offer the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. And without objection, the Chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, Senate file 1968 as amended. Thanks, folks, for being here.
Thank you.
Next, we have Senator Magnus. Senate file 1618. And members, we have a very long agenda. We're going to be here until 11 o'clock, but it is my intention to make it all the way through all 13 items. And so we're roughly 9-10 minutes on average for each of these bills. But I want everybody to know what's going to happen here today. We are going to make it through the agenda here. Senator Magnus, Senate file 1618.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1618 attempts to ensure that local units of government that host wind farms receive the benefit of an agreement they struck many years ago when they negotiated a wind generation production tax as the wind energy and here in Minnesota wind industry here in Minnesota was expanding. The wind production tax has been a reliable source of revenue for local governments for many years. However, in the 2008 session, state policy regarding the treatment of wind generation production tax revenue with respect to levy limits was changed. Production tax revenue was made subject to levy limits, which had not previously been the case before 2008. Madam Chair and members, we currently do not have levy limits in place, but we want to remove this treatment of this source of revenue now so that we are not faced with a problem in the event that levy limits return sometime in a future legislative session. These jurisdictions need these resources to maintain the basic infrastructure, and they do. And we do not wish to deprive them of this source of revenue. With that, Madam Chair and members, I have Commissioner Dave Hinkles from Jackson County who would like to testify on the bill.
Commissioner Hinkles, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 1618. My name is Dave Hinkles, and I am a county commissioner from Jackson County. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the 18 counties which make up the Rural Minnesota Energy Board, a joint powers board of predominantly southern and southwestern Minnesota counties that have been closely monitoring state policy and local impacts relating to renewable energy development. It was the Rural Minnesota Energy Board that spearheaded the negotiations more than a decade ago to establish the wind generation production tax. There are real costs associated with hosting wind projects. Township and county boards experience significant wear and tear with the movement of construction and maintenance equipment to and from the wind farms. We rely on production tax revenue to maintain our county and township roads and bridges. The production tax helps maintain strong community support for this energy infrastructure. As Senator Magnus noted, until the 2008 legislative session, wind production tax revenues were not subject to levy limits. We are not certain why this issue came up late in the 2008 session, but we are requesting that this source of revenue not be subject to levy limits going forward. The wind energy production tax was treated as a general levy. Revenue from this tax was added to the county's bottom line and resulted in a decrease in county revenue equal to the wind energy production tax generated. This is a direct conflict with the original legislative intent of wind energy production. The production tax was designed to be used by counties to offset the damage to infrastructure caused by wind energy conversion system installation and to provide funds for the increased cost of fire protection public safety expenses. The production tax was also designed to be used as an incentive to counties to promote the development of wind production in their counties. Eliminating the benefits of production tax results in counties increasing their list of infrastructure. We respectfully request your support for Senator Magnus's bill, which would revert back to the treatment of production tax revenue prior to the 2008 amendment. Thank you for your consideration.
Madam Chair, I also have a letter from the Department of Revenue showing no fiscal impact since there are no levy limits in place now.
Senator Magnus, that was what I was going to ask you about. As of last year, there were no levy limits. Now, maybe this is a kind of a proactive measure here to make sure that if there are levy limits, we don't want to include this. You've just touched off what is a sore point with me, though. The levy limits don't mean anything if there are all kinds of exemptions, but we don't have them.
Right.
And I understand the argument that you're trying to make is if we do have them, we should not have levy limits that apply to this wind energy production. Questions or comments from the committee on this subject? Senator Rest is grinning with me. Senator Magnus, thank you for your work on this, and Commissioner, in bringing this out through a group of counties, you've brought more insight to the issue on levy limits. I really appreciate that. I would like to hold it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, so the Chair would like to lay over Senate File 1618 for possible inclusion without objection.
Right.
Senator Magnus
much.
And Commissioner, thank you so much. Next we have Senator Koch. So Bach is not here. Senator Howe is here. Senator Howe, Senate File 2174, the modification list of cities sharing Rochester local sales tax. Senator Senjum isn't here, however, Senator Howe. We might want Senator Senjum to join us for the conversation.
I can speak to that issue.
All right, good. Thank you. Please go ahead, Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What this bill seeks to do is just to include two additional cities that may have been overlooked. The agreement with the Rochester sales tax, it sets aside $5 million for communities that are around Rochester that may participate in a kind of a competitive process for that $5 million. So this doesn't change anything for Rochester. It's the same $5 million. What it does is it includes two additional cities, that being Wattamingo and Spring Valley. And it's truly a bipartisan bill because you have Senator Sparks, who represents Grand Meadow, and myself, who represents Wattamingo. And I do have just a testimony here that the mayor, Ron Berg from Wattamingo, and the administrator, Michael Bolton, had sent to me. And I'll just read this to the committee here. During the 2011 Minnesota legislative session, language was passed that reauthorized a half-cent sales tax for the city of Rochester pending voter approval. In the language, Rochester will need to vote on $139.5 million sales tax renewal by city voters in 2012. A total of $5 million would be eligible for current surrounding communities, or 17 towns and economic development projects. These towns have had close proximity and economic development authority. They are as follows: Byron, Chatfield, Dodge Center, Dover, Elgin, Eota, Hayfield, Casson, Manorville, Orinoco, Pine Island, Plainview, Spring Valley, St. Charles, Stuartville, West Concord, Zembrota, and this would include Spring Valley and also Wattamingo. These towns were picked by the tax committee staff. Staff went through the map surrounding area and looked at all the communities that had proximity to Rochester and had an economic development authority. A true comprehensive list was probably not included in the bill's language because of the lack of knowledge of the area and the time constraints. Wattamingo is within the 25-mile radius of Rochester. Wattamingo would be just as close, and they would say even closer if you used the northern side of Rochester, where the Walmart, Menards, Target, and Best Buy are located at. The change, including Wattamingo as ineligible for a small portion of the 1/2 cent sales tax, is what we're requesting. It would not guarantee funds. If it was to become law, it would at least give Wattamingo EDA a chance at a portion of the $5 million in sales tax proceedings for regional significant economic development.
Senator Howe, for these new cities that would be included, they would be included in the voter referendum, they would be included in the collection of the tax, and in the
Correct.
Receipt of the tax.
Correct.
All right. I do understand that Senator Sundrum is supportive. So.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, he is.
Are there questions or comments for members? Then without objection, the chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion Senate File 2174. Senator Howe, thank you. Senator Saxhog is here. And we'll take up Senate File 2077. Senator Saxhog, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, today we have Senate File 2077. This bill will authorize an LGA payment of $12,000 to the city of Tamarack, population 94, in calendar year 2013. This is a one-time payment and is being requested due to the population increase of over 55% the last census. With me today is Randy Wittenbeck, Mayor of Tamarack, and City Councilor John Sayers to give brief testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor Wittenbeck?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Requesting, we had, a major increase in our population in the last 10 years. We did put a new sewer system in, cost about $1.5 million. With that, we have increased our rates to try offsetting this. The city out of our general fund has spent roughly $65,000 to maintain this sewer system. So we've increased our rates to bring it up to where we need to be. What we're asking for is a little help to get some of that money back so we can do things with our city to keep up the repairs in our streets and safety in our town.
Thank you. And you said another, sir, can you introduce yourself?
Madam Chair, John Sayers, council person for the city of Tamarack.
Do you have something further to add, sir?
No, I think the mayor has actually put out what we wanted to say on this problem we have.
Well, folks, I'm wondering, this would be special legislation for Tamarack that would increase the calculation for local government aid specific only to Tamarack. Is that how it would operate, Mr. Mayor or
yes.
Senator? Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming down today. Been through Aiken quite a bit. Really enjoyed up there. So you built a new sewer system?
And yes, we had a sewer system put in, I do believe, back in 2002. We were kind of forced by the USDA to put this in. People's septic in town were failing. Was something we were forced to do. And since then, we've had problems with the failing. We received a correction action grant to help correct some of the problems on there. And like I said, we've spent $65,000 out of our general fund to help maintain the system, so we've increased our rates to help offset that thing, and now we're just trying to ask for the money to get back into our city, you know.
Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
So you put the sewer system in, was mandated, and you got a grant to do that, correct?
Yes.
And then what's currently happening is that that's not sufficient to cover all the expenses.
Yeah, we actually took out a loan to finish covering the expenses.
Okay. And one last thing. So do you currently receive LGA then?
Yes, we do.
Okay. So this extra $12,000 for this 1 year would close the deal and you'd be fine?
Yes, it would.
Okay. Senator Thank Chamberlain. You, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Sackhoff.
Senator Chamberlain, I guess I'd say that this situation in Tamarack is not unlike many situations up in our territory where these small towns with their septic or sewer systems are in desperate situations.
That's yeah, Senator Saxhog, it's not just limited to your communities. You know, I had my own bill for Norwood Young America because they have mandates. They have a new business that they want to add to the community. They need more hookups. They have to do improvements by mandate in order to accomplish that. And so I think we've created all these mandates that have put these smaller cities in Minnesota into terrible positions. And I think there might be a more straightforward way to accomplish this, you know, your solution here, but I commend you for trying to find some way to respond. I think we should have a much bigger conversation at the state level about how we're going to help these small cities with all these mandates that are basically unaffordable. And I think that's the crux of your problem here.
You're right. Senator You're Sackhoff. Right, Madam Chair. Thank you for those comments.
I hope you'll continue to help with this, Senator Sackhoff and Mr. Mayor, Council. Thank you for being here. Without objection, the Chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, Senate File 2077.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howell.
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Bach, you're next.
Madam Senator Chair, I just want to correct my part of my testimony when I spoke. The city that would be in Senator Sparks' area was Grand Meadow, not Spring Valley. Spring Valley is included. It's Grand Meadow and Wadamingo that would be included. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Thank you, Senator Howell. I hope to know all those cities someday, but right now I can't say I could distinguish where they all are, but I hope to. I've learned a lot about the geography of the
Apparently, Senator Howell doesn't know where they are either.
Hey, I've been to Grand Meadow many times.
Let's hope.
And Spring Valley.
Senator Bach, you have the local sales tax for Proctor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. what the bill is food and beverage tax for the city of Proctor, and we list the uses here, and I have Jake Benson with me here to talk about community support for it and what their needs are. Most of us realize that in small cities, food and beverage taxes don't raise a lot of money. The situation in Proctor is they are I don't want to call them a bedroom community to Duluth, but let's call them a suburban, a Duluth suburb almost. In fact, part of the city of Duluth actually attends the Proctor School, Bayview Heights, because it really, if you look at the city, it looks more like Duluth, looks more like Proctor than Duluth. And it just, so they have a reciprocity agreement there. In Duluth, a legislature has given the city of Duluth authorization to impose a food and beverage tax of 2.25%. So all the Proctor residents, when they go down the hill into Duluth to have dinner or breakfast or whatever, they pay 2.25% to the city of Duluth. And so the city of Proctor really feels that that they'd like to have the same kind of opportunity, not at 2.25%, but at 1%, to impose a food and beverage tax. They have strong support in the community for it, and it's a way to take some additional burden off of the property tax system. So, with that, Madam Chair, I have Jake Benson here from the city.
Councilman Benson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I am Jake Benson, a Proctor City Councilor and a Proctor businessman. I do thank you for this opportunity to testify on this very important bill for Proctor. I did bring along some handouts for you. We had a half a dozen people who wanted to attend, but because of various medical concerns and commitments, they have not been able to, but they did pass along some testimony. Included in there is a letter from our president of our Chamber of Commerce. You'll see that the chamber does support this. They supported it in 2011 and again in 2012. Just to give you a little idea about Proctor, it's slightly larger than 3 square miles and has slightly more than 3,000 residents. It's bisected by Highway 2 and I-35. We are bordered on two sides by the city of Duluth, which has a food and beverage tax, as Senator Bach explained, which is twice as more than what we're asking for. You know, Proctor was created to serve the mining industry. We're the largest iron ore sorting yard in the world. 20% of all the land in Proctor is owned by the Canadian National Railway, which cuts our community in half with its rail yards. 28% of all the developed property in Proctor is owned by the railroad, and they pay a fraction of what commercial and retail property owners do pay. Recently, the railroad neglected to break one of its rail cars. It rolled through a train crossing, hit another vehicle, and it cost Proctor its quiet zone, which we've had for years. Now the whistles blow every hour on the hour from the trains passing through that crossing, and it's great if you happen to love railroads, not so good if you're trying to get some sleep. It's going to cost Proctor upwards of $250,000 to create another quiet zone because of the railroad's negligence, and it's going to be the taxpayers of Proctor, not the railroad, who pays for it. Proctor, for the past 40 years, has been the entrance to Duluth Spirit Mountain Recreation Area. 80 of those acres of Spirit Mountain, the most valuable property in Proctor, is owned by the city of Duluth, and they pay no property taxes, yet we still have to provide the services. Proctor, for the past 91 years, has been the entrance to the South St. Louis County Fair, which until last year was located in Duluth, and Duluth very graciously detached their property so Proctor could annex it. An estimated 76,650 rooms are booked every year in Proctor at one of our three motels, with about 115,000 visitors or guests spending a night throughout the year. They go to our equine facilities, Speedway, Regional Recreation Center, Gun Club, Golf Course, and of course Spirit Mountain, Lake Superior, and Duluth. They go to events in Proctor, like the Blizzard ALS fundraiser, the largest snowmobile fundraising event in the United States, the MS-150, which is the largest and longest event in Minnesota for bicycles, and the Amsoil Snowcross snowmobile, which attracts 35,000 people to our town. Most recently, we've lost our canine officer, animal control officer, school resource officer, a park worker, and an office worker. Our infrastructure and our services are strained. Our city administrator, a lifelong Proctorite with an MBA, is working for our city for $14,000 a year just to help it. A food and beverage tax is important, and it has no financial impact on the state. So we do ask you for your support on 1445. Thank you, Senator.
Councilman Benson. I'm glad that you're so proud of your city, and I have been a guest there. I've stayed there on my way to the marathon and back. It's a very nice community. And I want to point out for folks that this is not a local option sales tax. This is not the same as a provision where we would require a referendum, and I'm going to have council speak to that so we can see that this is distinguishable from some of the other bills we've heard today. Senator Senjum has a very similar bill that we'll hear when he's here regarding the lodging tax for Rochester. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, That's correct. This is a hospitality tax, and it's because it's not a general sales tax applicable to all sales in the city, it's considered a special tax, and therefore it's not subject to the sales tax provisions of 297A. And it requires local approval of the governing body, but not local approval at a voter referendum.
Thank you. Questions or comments from the city of Proctor? Senator Senjum. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I was one of the first places I looked when the new redistricting map came out of the court was to see if I still had Proctor in my district. It is an incredibly community with a rich tradition. Never ask us for much, and this is an opportunity for them to be able to tax themselves to relieve some of the property tax burden in their community, and I really appreciate the committee's help with this.
Thank you, Senator. Questions or comments regarding the proposal from the city of Proctor? Seeing none, the chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion. Senate file, and I see it here. Here it is, 1445. Thank you, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you, Councilman. Senator Koch is here, and she has a proposal for the local sales tax of Clearwater. And I'm hoping that Mayor Monk and the Clearwater Finance Director, Sue Virgin, are also here. Welcome back to the committee. I know we heard Clearwater before, and Mr. Mayor, it's always nice to see you. Welcome back. I think you're looking for clarification here, but Senator Koch.
Yes. Madam Chair and members, this might feel a little deja vu to everyone. I think it's our third time in Senate Tax Committee.
I'm getting to know the mayor.
Third time's the charm. Mayor Monk just really enjoys the committee, I would have to say.
Absolutely.
So, members, Senate File 2155 is some clarification. The Clearwater sales tax was passed in 07?
Six.
Six. 06, we passed the Clearwater sales tax at... there was a referendum prior to that. Came back last year. We did some clarification, but as the mayor will explain to you, we're looking for a little further clarification for the usage of this fund. So,
thank you, Mr. Monk, or Mayor Monk.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, Senate. I'm going to defer to our financial director, who has been following this very close and is very attuned to what needs to be done.
Thank you, Ms. Virgin. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's an unfortunate situation that when we came back in 2011 and requested a technical amendment, we actually tied it to a resolution that actually adopted our comprehensive land use plan, not a capital improvement plan. And unfortunately, this language was not caught until we started pursuing options of using the funds. So what we did is we hope that we've gone back, we've done our due diligence, and we've very specifically written the language in the bill to be specific to projects. So it's very project specific. And so therefore, it's just the intent originally in the 2008 bill was for park and trail improvements along with a community center, and those are still in there. We've just identified the projects specifically with the technical amendment.
Virgin, questions or comments from the committee? Senator Koch?
No, Madam Chair, we'd appreciate support on this. And as I said, I do believe that we've really got it right now. It's just had to be a little more specific. So,
I know there were questions last year, Senator Koch, about the uses, and the language was drafted very broadly. And then we tied it, and we thought we were tying it to specific uses. It sounds like we tied it to the wrong set of documents. Mayor Monk.
It was tied to our CIP, and it should have been to our comprehensive plan.
No, vice versa.
The opposite way.
Opposite.
But it's always been intended for parks and trails, and that's what I understood back from even before in 2010 or whenever you were here the first time. It was intended to pay for parks and trails.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Back in 06 when we first passed it, that was always the intention. So then we came in with – we'd been working for several years to get the additional language in that we got in last year. That took about 3 or 4 years, and then even then it was tied to the wrong plan. So
all right.
Now we've got it.
Well, thank you all for being here. Without objection, the chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, Senate File 2155. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, are you here? don't see him, but maybe Senator Bach would like to go. Oh, he is. Senator Ingebretson. We have a City of Vergas aggregate tax bill, Senate File 2459. Welcome to the committee, Senator Ingebretson.
Bouncing between committees like everybody else today. Appreciate the time here. Senate File 2459 is a I don't ever say a small or a simple bill in this place. It just doesn't work.
Not in the Tax Committee, Senator Ingebretson.
No. Madam Chair and members, what this is it was a it allows the City of Vergas, which is a small town in north central Otter Tail County. The way I understand it, legislation now, counties have the authority to be able to charge taxes gravel hauled out of the gravel pits in their county. And if they choose not to do that, which in Otter Tail County I understand that they have chose not to do that, a city or a township may come to the legislature with special legislation to ask the very same permission. And nobody from Vergas was here today. This is, as you know, very all of a sudden this came forward, but it was fairly straightforward to be able to explain that it gives the local authority, the little city of Vergas, the opportunity to charge sales tax on their gravel from the gravel pit that they have within their jurisdiction. So that's basically the bill.
Senator Ingebretson, you might be surprised at how much conversation this committee has had about mining, aggregate taxes, reclamation projects, and you already have, I believe, a lot of support on this committee for your community's effort to try and wage a tax and then use those funds for the benefit of redevelopment. Is there any tie in the use of these tax dollars for that purpose, for redevelopment later?
I believe there is, Madam Chair, and I'm somewhat ill-prepared for that particular question, but I believe that is, are you talking reclamation costs and things like that? That was part of the discussion, yes.
Council, is there anything that references that in the bill? Senator, you might be well advised to consider that kind of addition if it's not in here. Mr. Sylvia.
Excuse me. Madam Chair and members, it does reference the use of the tax here and that it may impose the tax in the same manner as the county tax. It would be in Subsection 12, Paragraph C, all provisions in this section apply to the City of Vergas except that in lieu of the tax proceeds under Subdivision 7, all proceeds of the tax must be retained by the City, and I believe that would mean that the proceeds of the tax would be dispersed as they are for the county, and that would be 85% for roads and bridges and 15% for pit and quarry restoration, other conservation or environmental needs.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvia. I think that's very good information. Senator Dibble.
So just so I'm clear on that response, Madam Chair, those purposes for the tax are specifically spelled out or I heard assumed?
They're referenced to the county's purposes. Is that correct, Mr. Sylvia?
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, aggregate tax, those are the specific uses that are allowed, and this would simply allow the city to impose the tax, but it would be used in the same manner as the county tax would be.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
So allowed sounds permissive and not specific. They could use it for one or the other, but not, for example, to...
Mr. Sylvia, is it permissive, or are those the authorized uses for the tax?
I believe, Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, it would be the authorized use for the tax in this case as opposed to any county and city that chose to impose the tax.
Well, and Senator Dibble, I'm noting on the revenue note here, the county does not have an aggregate materials tax, and then if the City of Vergas passes it and then the county of Otter Tail wants to impose it, then they can only have the one tax. So we're not going to have one tax on top of the other. There are authorized uses for this, including 15% for reclamation, 85% for infrastructure, roads, and bridge-related. I think it was good policy when it was passed.
Great.
Other questions or comments for Senator Ingebrigtsen? Is there anyone here that would like to testify? Mr. Corrigan, welcome to the committee.
Chair, I do have a handout for the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you again. My name is Fred Corrigan. I'm executive director of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota. I'm here today to oppose Senate File 2459, which seeks to authorize the City of Vergas to impose an aggregate production tax. The Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota believes the legislative intent of Minnesota Statute 298-75, as proposed by the Aggregate Resources Task Force in the laws of 1998 and revised in 2008, was for this tax to be imposed and collected by counties to ensure a fair and level playing field for aggregate producers in the local marketplace. The Otter Tail County Board of Commissioners held a hearing on the aggregate tax in 2006 and took no action. Local aggregate producers in the county opposed the tax at that time and continue to be opposed to a county or local tax. This bill is based on an exemption that was granted to 10 St. Louis County townships in 1997, and specifically Subdivision 9, Part B, for purposes of exercising the powers contained in the section the town is deemed to be the county. We believe the intent of this provision, as you were just discussing, is that any town agreeing with this provision would be obligated to meet all of the requirements imposed on counties imposing this tax in Subdivision 7. We have some feeling that this is a tax looking for a purpose. There is one mine in the city of Vergas. There are two properties that are no longer mining and have not been reclaimed. The mining property that's currently mining has a contract with its miners to reclaim the mine as it mines. So they are required under contract to reclaim the property that they are mining. So we're not sure exactly what the city intends to do in terms of reclamation. There should be no reclamation when this mine is completed. We would ask this committee to table this bill and others like it until 2013 to allow this committee to revisit the provision for the purposes of exercising the powers contained in this section. The town is deemed to be the county, and to work with the aggregate industry, the Association of Counties, the Minnesota Association of Townships, and League of Minnesota Cities to clarify the meaning and responsibilities of this provision. I want to be clear that ARM and its membership believes that this tax should be a statewide tax, but has worked with the Aggregate Resources Task Force in 1998 and 1999, endorses a county-based collection of this tax with opt-in provisions for the county, and believes that local government collection of the tax represents a host community fee resulting in distortion of the marketplace impacting both the public and private sectors who pay this tax and should not be authorized. We do not believe the townships or the city of Vergas have the resources to properly administer this tax, whereas counties usually have both the resources and, as the permitting authority, the expertise to properly meet the intent of the statute, administer the tax collection, and implement the reclamation of abandoned pits.
Mr. Corrigan, were you or other representatives of your association present during the many conversations we have had in this committee about mining reclamation and the use of TIF dollars for that purpose?
I am, Madam Chair, and we've been monitoring your discussion, and as you know, I've been trying to get your office to discuss some of the implications of those.
Mr. Corrigan, I'm aware of that over about the last 48 hours since we noticed this bill, but not before that. Mr. Corrigan.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I believe our members have been involved with you in Maple Grove and Apple Valley.
That's correct, Mr. Corrigan. A question for you. Does your association have a position on the use of TIF as a statewide policy for reclamation when there is no fund set up through an aggregate tax?
Madam Chair, we don't. We will look at that position. However, it's a very urban issue. And it's very difficult for rural Minnesota to even understand what TIF means or what implications it might have for their properties. They aren't going to be redeveloped for commercial purposes. They're usually redeveloped, and I would guess this property in Vergas will end up being a residential property at some time, perhaps. Most of them are turned back into farm fields when they're finished.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and Mr. Corrigan, and to the committee, I guess. You know, when I listened to what Mr. Silva said, 15% of the tax was for reclamation, but 85% was for roads. So the primary use of this tax by the local community is to do road repair because of all the traffic from the comings and goings of the gravel pit. So, I mean, reclamation is important. It's good that they have a contract to do that, but I would expect that the city of Vergas is planning on using these tax dollars to do road maintenance from the loads traveling through its community.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Corrigan.
In this case, Senator, the aggregate producers and their trucks access this property from a county road and only use county roads in and out of this property. So we're not sure what the basis of the city of Vergas is for collecting a tax for road and bridge when the trucks don't use their system.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen first, and then Senator Howell.
Thank you,
Senator
Madam Chair. To Mr. Corrigan's issues here, you know, I don't know of any study that's going on. I guess maybe you do, Madam Chair, about the this particular instance, but it's been very clear that have been other townships and other cities in the state of Minnesota that have done this, and there's even been some talk about all of the small town of Vergas, whatever town it is, small or large, wouldn't be able to manage this anyhow, wouldn't be able to collect the tax. Well, I guess I wouldn't count on that so much. I mean, the budgets are being stretched just like they are at the state level, and I think they're more than capable of stepping up and knowing how to charge their folks for a product if they're selling it no different than anybody else. And I certainly wouldn't be sitting in front of you here with a statewide tax, that's for sure. That would take an awful lot more discussion than we're talking about here. And if this particular group is in favor of a statewide tax, I'm not sure that's the route to go. But this is a small town that wants to exercise their ability by statute to be able to do that, and if the county's not willing to do it, they have the opportunity, the way I understand, to do that. And I understand, you know, and quite frankly, the free market is the free market. If they want to drive someplace else for their gravel and they don't want to pay that 6.75% per unit, they certainly have a right to do that, and Vergas knows that. I mean, the city of Vergas is taking that chance when they do that. I mean, that's just part of doing business.
Well, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I would point out, and this is more of the geography lesson this morning, but the city of Scambler has imposed this aggregate tax. I don't know how it relates in terms of size. Scambler Township.
Township,
thank you. I knew I was going to learn a little something about Vergas this morning. Now I'm learning about Scambler. And they are imposing this as a township within Ottertail County. So they seem to be perfectly capable of doing it. Senator Howe.
Oh, Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think with a little slight modification in this bill, I think you know if you would change just a few things in here and just call instead of the city of Vergas, just say a political subdivision, and we could take care of this for townships, villages, and municipalities around the state just by making it that political subdivisions can do it if the county doesn't do it. And then we don't have to worry about other villages or townships or cities coming back in front of us to do exactly what we've done for other people and what we probably intend to do for Vergas. So I'm just wondering if we shouldn't just make a slight change to this and take care of it.
Well, Senator Howe, I think that's pretty bold. And one of the things I think is a good thing about here is the public awareness you get when a city comes to the legislature and says we want to impose a tax. You get a public awareness and a public conversation about it. But I would take that under advisement. I know Mr. Sylvia has some technical changes that he would like to suggest for you, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that will make your provision mirror much more closely what's been done in Scambler, if you don't have any objection to that.
Oh,
and maybe Mr. Sylvia could read those suggested changes for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and Senator Ingebrigtsen. In looking at the particular statute that authorized the imposition of this tax for the Township of Scambler, the only change that may be made, just to make this perhaps a little tighter, is in subdivision 12, paragraph C. As it states right now, it says all provisions in this section apply to the city of Vergas, except that in lieu of the tax proceeds under subdivision 7, all proceeds of the tax must be retained by the city And as a possible recommendation, we might add after the word city, just that this sentence that says, and used for the purposes described in Subdivision 7. And Subdivision 7 is the subdivision that outlines the percentage of uses. Right now, it doesn't specify that the uses are necessarily tied into paragraph 7. That might just be a suggestion so that paragraph 7 specifically outlines the intended uses of the proceeds.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Madam Chair, to understand that clearly, then, that would be the 85% for road and bridge fund, and 15% would be set aside for reclamation. Is that what the subdivision 7 talks about, basically?
Mr. Sylvia.
I apologize.
I'm sorry. The 85-15 split is referred to in subdivision 7?
Correct. It's outlined as 42.5% for county road and bridge, 42.5% for general fund for city or town, and then 15% for the restoration of abandoned pits. So it's the percentage as outlined in the statute for the proceeds of the normal aggregate tax, and that's what it's tied back into for the township of Scambler.
I know, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're strapped for time, but when you're talking about a city, then and you put in there that they're going to be repairing county roads, I'm not sure where that fits in. I guess if it's a county state aid.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
That sounds fine to me. If that's what subdivision says relates to something similar to that in the same county, I think it's a good idea.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, we are going to, without objection, hold this over for possible inclusion. And then in the bill, when I present it, we'll include the suggestions from Mr. Sylvia, if that's acceptable to you. Senator Hoffman, comments about the proposal?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. As everybody on this committee knows, I live a mile out of Urgus. That's my district that I represent. And I'm trying to figure out, and I'm sorry I came in late. I had an appointment I had to keep. But I'm trying to figure out where is the aggregate pit that they want to tax from. I'm not sure which one they're going for. The city of Urgus never contacted me about this bill. So when I heard about it, I was surprised. I live a mile away. I'm easy to find.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, number one, where they're going to impose the tax. Where's the pit that they're going to impose the tax on? And then how much does the city of Urgus think that they can raise? That's what I'm trying to figure out here. And I'm trying to figure out what purpose, where's the budget hole? If had they invited me to the meeting, perhaps I'd have these answers, but they didn't.
Madam Chair?
Senator,
if I might, if this is going to be held over, I would get that. Be more than happy to get that information, exactly which pit it is and exactly how much revenue I guess it's not exact, but approximate amount of revenue they think they're going to generate. And how they're going to go about doing it, quite frankly, I think that's kind of an interest.
Well, and I mean, I know where maybe my question's rhetorical, because I know where the two gravel pits are around Vergas, but I'm just trying to figure out which one is already closed. And so I don't know if either one of you have the answer to that.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe it's on County Road 31. It's a farm property, farmstead, and they're farming, they're mining in the back. There are two miners in the back of it. Senator, I'm not sure. We were never aware of a hearing at the City Council around this. The property owner wasn't aware of this until we made him aware of it. And we weren't aware of this, the county board taking this up until after the resolution took place. So we have talked to the county board. They have decided not to rescind their support, but the process could have been better. Madam Chair, if I could just one
Mr.
comment.
Corrigan.
We didn't in 2008, the industry did support doubling the tax, recognizing that local governments, the host communities, do suffer from some of the effects of this industry. And we agreed to go from 7 cents per ton to 15 cents per ton or yard. I always get those backwards to make sure that local communities did have enough resources to look after the impact of the industry in their community. So we are supportive of the host communities. We just believe this is better held and better managed at the county level. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Senator Ingebrigtsen and Senator Hoffman, I hope that you will share some information here, look at the language changes and advise members of the committee about what, you know, what you'd like to do here, but for without further objection, I'd like to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you want to present the bill for the city of Alexandria as well? Senate file 2368.
Please, if I could. Along with me today, I have the mayor of Alexandria, Mayor Dan Ness, and Jim Taddy, who is the city administrator. In the interest of brevity, Jim was telling me he had about a 30-minute speech, so I thought maybe. Mayor, of course, 45 or nothing more than 45 minutes.
I'll get another cup of coffee, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Mr. Mayor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman and Senators. I appreciate this opportunity to be here. I'm going to yield to our City Administrator, Jim Taddy, who has some information that we think is very pertinent to this bill.
Thank you.
Before we start, maybe a little bit about Senate File 2368. It was brought to me by these two gentlemen at a meeting in the city of Alexandria. And quite frankly, they were just saying we in Alexandria are a regional city, if you would, in that we have a lot of community around us, of course, that comes to Alexandria for many different reasons. We have tremendous medical facilities there as well as shopping facilities. And in rural Minnesota, you have cities like this throughout the state, as you know, Fergus Falls being one, Alexandria being one, and some of those that you have to have a certain number. You have to meet a certain threshold, and that's 10,000 population in order to qualify as, I guess, in statute, regional city. So that's what this legislation is attempting to do, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Taddy.
Okay, Madam Chair, if I may add some information. I hope you have the packet of information in front of you regarding this Senate File 2368.
We do, Mr. Taddy. Thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you. The first page, essentially what I want to do there is just list those regional centers throughout the state of Minnesota. It just so happens that on that page, the sub-regional center is Alexandria listed also. And our intention, our position is that Alexandria is a regional center, and that's, and therefore qualifies for the additional local government aid under that program. The second sheet is just a map showing communities around Alexandria that are regional centers: Fergus Falls, Brainerd, St. Cloud, Wilmer, Fargo, Moorhead. Unlike some other perhaps cities that may qualify population-wise, those cities may be suburbs of existing regional or major cities such as St. Cloud or Duluth, Rochester. We're Alexandria. The point there in Alexandria, we have our own trade area separate from those other communities. And the third sheet, page 3, is information provided by the House Research, which were very helpful, as how those regional centers, over 10,000, were designated, what information did they look at, and there were four items. First was the census population, 2,000. That average for those centers, those regional centers that I gave you a list of before, is 16,977 population. Alexandria's 2010 population is 11,070. I will note that under a recent annexation, we're in a phase 4, 12-year annexation, our last phase right now. There'll be additional population of estimated about 1,396 people. So you're looking at about 12,400 or so population, 2012. The second factor was population growth from 1990 to 2000. For those regional centers, it's 6.2%. In our case, if you look at 2000 to 2010, our population growth is 25%, 0.5%, primarily because of the orderly annexation agreement we have. The third factor was 2000 medium household income for those regional centers. There are $35,768. The medium household income from Alexandria, 2010, is $32,976, very close. And the fourth factor was the per capita amount of commercial industrial property or value in the community. For those regional centers, the average was $7,075. Alexandria was $35,104. That's the technical justification for, the regional center classification for Alexandria. But from a practical matter, a common sense approach, I think the mayor's got some thoughts as to why Alexandria is a regional center.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, further comments?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. In addition to the statistics that you've just heard, the county seat aspects are very apparent. The county has the courthouse, obviously. They also have a public works building. They also house the county highway department. They have a county jail. They have a county law enforcement building. They have a county library, all located within the city. We have a Social Security office, federal offices. We have Minnesota Soil and Water Districts. They're doubting my memory because of my advanced age. The county hospital has had two major additions over $37 million recently. 40% of their admits come from our Alexandria zip code. 60% therefore come from outside the city in our area. We have a Veterans Administrative Community Outreach Clinic that was established 2 years ago. Very successful, very, very busy. We have a regional airport. We are on Interstate 94, and we have a Central Lakes Trail for recreation purposes. Our industry is very significant. We have more jobs in the city than we do population, which is a wonderful situation. We're very glad. If you recall from the statistics, Jim quoted the per capita amount of commercial industrial value, ours was in 2010 was $35 million, while the average for regional centers is $7 million. We are blessed with an industrial hub as well. But along with the hub issues are the overburdens of regional centers. We know of that. We've been trying since 2003, quite frankly, but because of the LGA formula, which required the usage of the federal census, not the state demographer, we've not been able to approach you with the request to correct the classification of Alexandria as a regional center and not a sub-regional center. There will be other marketing consequences as well that we're aware of. So for all those reasons, we come before you and urge you to adopt the bill that Senator Ingebrigtsen has been good enough to author for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And gentlemen, I think you make a very good case. However, I would say that the whole regional center aid as part of our local government aid is a study in contradictions. You qualify for regional center aid if you have so many numbers of jobs and you have if you look at your regional retail centers that you have there, it means that you're doing well. And the whole theory of regional center aid is that there's an overburden. And so that's the contradiction, I think, that we have here in the committee with the formula. There are three, I think, and counting study groups underway right now with relating to property taxes and or LGA specifically. There is a legislative commission on LGA, there's a governor's task force on LGA, and there is a working group on property taxes. All of these groups are underway now and are expected to make recommendations about how we do a comprehensive reform of LGA and property taxes. Their recommendations are due in January of 2013. And I don't know where other members of the committee are with this, but we are trying to have a much bigger conversation. Yours is a very good example of why the current formula isn't working very well, honestly. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I would agree with your assessment there. And there's some other what I would call regional centers, too. And obviously this language, especially on page 7, is carefully crafted.
so it would address, you know, some maybe just a specific area. But a question for the mayor, does Alexandria have a local option sales tax, or does it not?
Senator Howell, Chairman, the Alexandria does not have a local optional sales tax. In fact, if we had 0.25%, we wouldn't need any LGA at all.
That's another one of the contradictions right there, Senator Howell. There's no reason why they couldn't. The city of St. Cloud has been making that case for a long time, and others have as well, and I think that's one of the factors that we should consider here. Can you raise these taxes locally so that there isn't an LGA payment? Have you considered a local option sales tax, Mr. Mayor?
Madam Chairman, in fact, the matter is we've had unsuccessful local sales tax options for Performing Arts Auditorium about 10 or 15 years ago, and it went down in flames 2-1. We're still feeling the burns from that. So we've not proposed one since then.
Sounds like we've left you in a very difficult situation because you're not yet a regional center for purposes of calculating the formula, and you've got folks at home that aren't that comfortable with a local option sales tax.
You're exactly correct.
Have you participated in these working groups and commissions? If not, I urge you to participate.
Well, of course we have. Through the coalition and the League of Cities, we have involved in that, but they always seem to be going on and on. And in the meantime, we need to have a resolution to this, and that's why Senator Ingebretson is proposing this bill to address it.
Mr. Taddy, I appreciate that, but I would say the coalitions do a good job, but they need very good specific examples, and the more specific we can get, and the more participation there is with lots of different, I mean, the story of Alexandria is just not the same as some other cities in the state of Minnesota, and they all should be considered in these working groups. Yeah. Other questions or comments from the committee?
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, is there anyone here that would like to testify either for or against the city of Alexandria's proposal? Seeing none, the chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, Senate File 2368.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it so much.
Next, we have Senator Hoffman's sales and use tax exemption for nursing homes. And members, I just want to give you a heads up on this bill. I am hopeful that if the committee hears it and is supportive, that we could offer this as an amendment to the omnibus tax bill that will be on the Senate floor tomorrow. And that's the purpose for which we're having this hearing on this today, because it does have a very slight revenue impact. There's money left on the bottom line in the tax bill that we passed out last week that will be heard tomorrow. And I'm hopeful that members of this committee would support Senator Hoffman's effort here to amend the bill. Senator Hoffman, you have Senate File 2164.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 2164 is a bill that will give a tax exemption to nursing homes and boarding care homes, a sales tax exemption. And I think instead of me going through it, I'm going to let Ms. Thurlow go through it and explain the history and why it's an important thing that we need to do, especially with the way the nursing homes are getting pinched now with the way the budgets have been and the economy. So I think I'll turn it over to Ms. Thurlow and let her give. I could do it, but I think she's got more of a history to it than I do.
Ms. Thurlow, good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I work with Aging Services of Minnesota, and I'm also here representing the Long-Term Care Imperative. By way of history, this bill does apply to the nonprofit nursing homes in Minnesota. The vast majority of nonprofit nursing homes already have a sales tax exemption and have had one for some time. But due to the Department of Revenue's changed interpretation and application of the rules for charitable exemptions that apply to sales tax, we now find ourselves in a situation where potentially nonprofit nursing homes cannot meet the current test. The issue is, and it's a similar issue that we dealt with under property taxes a few years ago related to the Under the Rainbow case. If you recall, in that particular case, the Minnesota Supreme Court clarified the test for allowing exemptions for charitable organizations. And one of the tests, one of the prongs of the test was that a charity must give away services for free or reduced cost. Nursing homes by statute in Minnesota are precluded from doing so because of the rate equalization law that holds that the medical assistance rate and the private pay rate must be the same. And as a result, nonprofit nursing homes would not be able to meet that current test.
Ms. Thurlow, can I interrupt you? I'm sorry. Did I hear you correctly? Are you saying that they can't meet the test of providing free or reduced rates because of the rate equalization?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That is our understanding. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we addressed this issue on the property tax side some years ago in the aftermath of the Under the Rainbow case. Because that case only dealt with property taxes at that time, we were not aware that this was also an issue on the sales tax side. The bill before you that Senator Hoffman is authoring, and we want to thank Senator Hoffman for bringing this bill forward, is identical language to what we put in on the property tax side and essentially clarifies that nonprofit nursing homes that meet all other aspects of the test and that do participate in the medical assistance program would have a sales tax exemption. And essentially this would take care and ensure that nonprofit nursing homes would retain their sales tax exemption and that they would all be treated equally under current law or under the law.
Thank you. Questions or comments from the committee? Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I was going to say I served as a director for Under the Rainbow, and I would say that issue is not quite completely resolved, but it is this extends that problem, and it does need to be addressed.
Sir, you're here to testify either for or against this bill?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Toby Pearson with Care Providers in Minnesota, also with the long-term care imperative.
Sir, could you speak up just a little more? It's really hard to hear in this room. It's not you. It's the acoustics.
It might be me because I have a little bit of a cold. But, Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson, Care Providers in Minnesota, with the long-term care imperative, and we support the bill.
Thank you. Are there other folks here that would like to testify one way or the other on Senate File 2164? Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, just a quick question for Ms. Thurlow. The revenue note mentions a small number of nursing homes that are exempt do not qualify. I don't quite get why some do and some don't.
Ms. Thurlow.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll try my best to answer that question, and I'm not sure if members of the department would also be able to clarify. This issue came to our attention. There were two nursing homes late last fall that, due to ownership changes, had to make either applications or to continue the sales tax exemption. In both instances, this is how the issue came to our attention. The exemptions were denied. Those issues are currently pending under appeal. They are not currently paying sales tax, as those issues are still pending. But we know of two nursing homes that are dealing with this issue at this moment.
Thank you, Senator Martin.
Madam Chair, what I'm trying to get at, though, is will all nonprofit nursing homes face this eventually? I'm not quite understanding the distinction. Was it because there was a change in ownership?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, in both instances, there were a change of ownership status in those two nursing homes. Madam Chair, Senator Marty, my understanding is that these issues only come to the department when there is either a change in ownership status or they're reviewed at that time. All of the other nonprofit nursing homes have had a sales tax exemption for some time, and unless there was some changed circumstance, my understanding is they don't come before the Department of Revenue for review.
I would ask counsel, she can advise us. I think that the language is drafted broadly enough so that now it should apply to everyone and regardless of a change in ownership. Ms. Pollitt.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. And the statute defines nursing homes as they're defined under Section 144A, which governs the nursing home licensure. So I believe that all nursing homes licensed and that meet the criteria under this language would be exempt from sales tax under this bill.
And Madam Chair, if I may add, we did work with the department on this language. We understand that this they agree that this language does take care of the issue, and we're not aware they do not oppose this language. We understand.
Ms. Von Mosch, anything from the department on this subject? Morning.
The agency did work on the language for this bill. This is a situation where there is an appeal, an administrative appeal. We work on language to get the language so that it is operational and so that it can be administered well, but we have no position, technical position, on this bill.
So, Madam Chair, members, if I may again, Toby Pearson, the goal was to take the existing property tax exemption qualifying facilities and make sales tax apply to the same thing. So we're using the same test. It's intended to not broaden or restrict, but to keep it the same moving forward.
Ms. Von Moschen, I would just comment that I think it's unfortunate that we have to write legislation for this. I think this is something that the department might have looked into and resolved in the interest of looking back at legislative intent and the number of people affected by this, the amount on the revenue note. We are here to do that, but I think it's unfortunate that there wasn't a greater effort on the part of the department to work this out. Ms. Von Moschen?
Madam Chair, I don't know the specific details of the appeal process or this situation, but the department does administer the laws as written, and so we are, when we go out to audit and when we look at these situations, we are following state law as it is written at the time.
Well, I know that the department issues rules and does clarifications and policy statements and opinions and everything else, and there would seem to me plenty of room here for the department to have made an adjustment without folks having to come for legislation. But nonetheless, I think we've got strong legislative support to provide to the department, lots of direction. Any questions or comments from members regarding Senate File 2164? Senator Bott.
We all are going to have a conversation in this room about who we exempt from sales tax. I am not in any way indicating that nursing homes' status on the change. Sales tax.
Well, you probably do.
That. You just let us know. Commissioner Rance has a very good presentation of that rule for the school. That shows what's been happening in sales tax collections over the last couple of decades. And we all need to. As members of the tax committee, those of us that are back here next year, we are going to have to take a look at all the things that would be taxed that the legislature not exempted. And lobbyists are going to get a lot of contracts next year when we do that, because I told Senator Bonoff was lobbying me the other day on how important the horses are in the district now, because she picked up a larger rural area of Plymouth, and she now has a bunch of horse owners in her district. And I told her, I said, you know, Senator Bonoff, I was in the House when we accepted hay from the sales tax. She said, what? They don't pay sales tax on hay? I said, well, no, Senator Bonoff, it's food. It's food for the horses. So my friends in the lobbying community, start lining up clients, because next year we're going to have a conversation around here as we try to get the state's fiscal house back in order. We're going to have to examine some of the things that are just purely exempted, because at a time when the legislature had some money, we thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't charge sales tax on some things? And that list has gotten bigger and bigger over the years, and we further have eroded our sales tax system. So just a something I think for people to think about. And I know groups come to the tax committee when the spending committees don't have any money. When they have no money to get to an appropriation, they come here looking for an exemption. And I just think the conversation is not going to go about what more we're going to exempt next year. I think very close scrutiny and why things are exempted is something this committee's going to have to.
Senator Bach, I couldn't agree more. And the 21st Century Tax Commission made some very strong recommendations about that. If you broaden the base, you could reduce the sales tax rate by a very significant amount. And I think it's unfortunate, but we are in the practical business of looking at who should be exempted instead of broadening that base and deciding to have a good conversation about overarching tax policy. And I do hope that, you know, when we all go back and stand for election in the legislature, House members and Senate members, that gives new authority to members to come back, and hopefully members will go out and candidates will go out and have this conversation with voters and get that authority. Senator Boss.
Madam Chair, I think the public has an assumption they're paying sales tax on it. I've had some people in my office this session that, like you, Madam Chair, many of them have wore eyeglasses. And one of my favorite questions to ask somebody that comes in, well, how much sales tax have you paid on your eyeglasses? And they said, well, you know, 6.5%. And I say, oh, you didn't pay any. But I think there's a perception that taxes are being charged. And just eyeglasses alone, and I'm not advocating we tax them, but we need to have a conversation. I think the last report I looked at, tax expenditures, show about $38 million a year. The state is giving up because we specifically ignore it. And that, those are the kind of conversations are going to be hard around here, but we simply have to have.
Senator Bach, my favorite example is landscaping services versus lawn care. One's taxable with sales tax, the other one isn't. The lawn or the landscaping is considered a service, but the lawn care is considered a product. And so you can hire somebody to mow your lawn and you pay sales taxes. If you hire a landscaper, not taxed. There's not really a good reason for that distinction. I can't think of one. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, there was a reason that was done.
A good one, Senator Bach?
Former taxpayer Senator Johnson in here sometime, get him down here, but he would tell you that back in the 80s when the state had a difficult recession, they took a look at a group of services and determined that while those services are considered luxuries, and they made a decision much like where we charge sales tax on furs, they made a decision that dry cleaning is a luxury, so we should charge sales tax on it. That lawn care services are a luxury that we should charge sales tax on. So there's a small menu of services where that kind of was what they considered is, well, if it's a luxury item, maybe we can charge sales tax on it. And that's kind of how we got where we are, is my understanding of the history.
I would say this is the lesson of the camel's nose under the tent. The camel is completely in the tent right now. There's nothing left. Senator Howe.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My favorite example is the Three Musketeer and the Twix. One's tax and one's not, because the Twix has enough flour content that it's food. So, I mean, whenever we have a candy dish, I'd always take a Twix because it's non-taxable. You know, I can make that point. But I think there's a lot to be said for what you obviously, I know Senator Artman, the chair, is in the same camp of we need to look at broadening the base, reducing the rate, going away from such a heavy reliance on the income tax.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm enjoying this discussion about the Twix bars and everything else, and I think the chair and Senator Bach and Senator Howe are right that we really do have to look at this. I'm thinking of what Ms. Thurlow and Senator Hoffman are thinking as they're coming here with a little thing to fix an inequity between some nonprofit nursing homes and others, and they're seeing they're stepping right into this discussion. But I think we do need this discussion. I also think this is an equity one between nonprofit nursing homes right now.
Senator Hoffman, are you open to a great big fat amendment on your
bill?
Members, I hope that we can accommodate Senator Hoffman by adding this amendment to the omnibus bill that is on the Senate floor. But without objection, I'd like to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Senator
Hoffman, thank you. Senator Senjum is here with, I'm guessing it relates to Rochester. It is. It's the Rochester Lodging Tax Authority Local Food and Beverage Tax. Senator Senjum, it's Senate File 2211, and Senator Howe already passed the modification of cities sharing the Rochester local sales tax. So we've already heard a little bit about it, but I know this one relates to the local food and beverage tax for Rochester. We did hear a similar proposal, folks, for Proctor. If you remember, I pointed out the fact that this is a lodging tax and not a local option sales tax that's being considered here. Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, I'll be real quick. In 2009, this legislature authorized the city of Rochester to impose an additional 1% on their lodging tax and enact a 1% food and beverage tax, the purposes of which would pay off the bonds on the planned expansion of the Mayo Civic Center. At this point, they've reconsidered this from the standpoint of the food and beverage tax, wanting to remove that to instead replace it with a 3% addition on top of an already existing 4% lodging tax, and that would then be used to match up and pay the bond, the local bonds off on the proposed, again, expansion of the Mayo Civic Center. I've got City Council President Dennis Hansen with me. He can cover anything I didn't. It's pretty straightforward, and would certainly hope for your consideration, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Senator. Mr. Hansen, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Senator Bach. It's good to see you again. I will just answer any questions. I think the Senator covered it very well, so if there's any questions, I will answer them. Otherwise, we'll get out of your hair.
Senator Senator, does the has Mr. Wade spoken, the Honorable Mr. Wade?
Thank you. Senator, we just think that it is a fair amount, and we believe that it leaves us in a very competitive position as we look for additional business globally and throughout the United States.
Senator Bach.
Chairman, Senator Sendrum, did I hear the conversation right? The lodging tax is going to go from 4% to 7%? Just lodging?
Senator Sendrum?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, that is correct, and Mr. Wade or Mr. Hansen may have better numbers than I have, but that is not unusual in the industry.
Mayor Bach.
I have to believe that gives you the highest local tax on lodging in the state, higher than Minneapolis. I'm fine.
Yeah,
if the city wants to do that,
I don't believe it is, but Mr. Newman, do you want to respond to that? Is that fair, Senator?
Sure. Mr. Newman, if you just died. I think it's Mr. Newman, if you
yes.
Identify yourself for the record. And
Mr. Chair, I'm Gary Newman. I'm the Assistant City Administrator. I believe it would make us equal to Bloomington and slightly above Minneapolis, but we don't have a food and beverage tax or any other taxes to go along with it. I believe there's several other cities that are at 6% in the state. So we'd have our lodging tax would be towards the top of the lodging taxes, but overall we'd be in kind of the middle of the cities that have a lodging tax plus some food and beverage taxes or other taxes. So we still would be, I think, cumulatively in the middle or towards the lower end, but higher on lodging, less on the rest.
And, Senator, it's also important to note
Mr.
that
Wade.
As we look at markets including Baltimore, Houston, and Cleveland, we remain very competitive and certainly lower than their rates.
Senator Bach.
Sales tax on a convention starts to become well all into the double digits, 14-15%. It starts to become real money to people looking to book large events. So I certainly want to help the city and the business community, but you need to run some risk. Taxes eventually start to matter. People don't ask me what your room rate is when they call. They don't generally ask, well, how much tax do you have? But
I do.
You start to get up that high, I think at some point, people are competing for convention-type business. It's going to start to matter. And you may be well right. Certainly, there are places in the country, Orlando and such, that have pretty high rates. But mm-hmm. We also have a lot of attractions.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Senator Bach and anybody
Senator.
Else, Mr. Wade mentioned those cities in part because, in fact, in large part because they are there are cities which compete at a national level for healthcare patients, and so that is what he's referencing again.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking for a bill. Senator Sengen, when's the effective date of this proposed change?
Mr. Chair and members. I'm looking to, and perhaps Senate Counsel can help me, but as I recall, the previous bill was to be enacted by the City Council upon the authorization of the and approval of the project that related to the expansion of the Mayo Civic Center.
Senator Rest, let's just have Senate Counsel confirm that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, Senator Sengen is correct. The bill is effective the day after the City Council approves the changes and then files a record of the approval with the Secretary of State.
So Senator Sengen, you would intend that this would apply to those of us that are going to attend the our party's state convention, right? We're trying to get that in before that happens.
Senator Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, here's the City Council President. Maybe you can talk to him about the enacting date.
I'm just kidding. But we will notice.
Senator Bach.
Well, maybe the department can answer this, but does that business will need, and there are going to be software changes that have to be made in the entire business community.
Why not?
This doesn't mechanically work for the businesses that have to do the collection and the remittance to the Department of Revenue. So the department's fine with the enactment date. I'm fine with it, but I think there's an issue there. We make sure that mechanically.
Looks like Mr. Newman wants to tackle that, and I see Ms. Von Mosch too. Mr. Newman?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, The law also requires us to have a full financing plan for the Mayo Civic Center expansion in place. So that's why we have not imposed the tax to date. So what we would do is we would approve the special law, and the tax won't go into effect till subsequent time, and we know there has to be plenty of notice before the tax goes into place for the businesses. So this tax will only go into place if we end up with a full financing plan for the Mayo Civic Center, and then that would be sometime hence. So it would not be, the earliest would likely be, if we got the bonding, would be probably January 1 of next year.
Mr. Bach, I can see the revenue folks are huddling over your questions. Senator Bach.
I've had conversations with the Department of making changes to the sales tax system. They've always talked about the department not actually being able to implement any legislative changes made in Alcalia, but the review is not over. So just want to make sure the planning we have relative to that works.
Mr. Von Mosch, if you could help us out on that issue, please.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bach, Susan Von Mosch with the Department of Revenue. Senator Bach is correct. Normally we enact changes to sales tax at the quarter, and typically there needs to be a one quarter's advance notice. So it would depend on when the City Council takes its vote, but it would need to be timed so that there is some advance notice to get the systems in place to notify merchants to put everything in place. But we can work with the author of the bill to make sure that the language is written in such a way to take into account that timeline.
Thank you, Ms.
Was he here right away? Mm-hmm. First, okay.
Senator Senjum, any concluding thoughts?
Chair and members, unless there are no other questions, I would move the bill to the discretion of the chair with respect to its location.
Senator Senjum, the chair has reminded me, and I see hands going up behind you, that we've got some other folks who want to testify to this bill. If you could maybe withdraw your motion. And,
I would withdraw that motion.
We'll make sure we get everyone on the record
first.
Mr. Bagnoli, your hand was up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli with the McGranchet Law Firm on behalf of the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, Retail, Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association. I'm here to support this, and I'm here because it is a rare day when the authorization for a tax on alcohol is taken off. So I want to congratulate the author and this committee for its consideration. As you all may know, alcohol in Minnesota is, I believe, the most uniquely taxed product in the state. It is the only product that has an excise tax as well as a gross receipts tax in addition to the sales tax on it. So I appreciate the City of Rochester's consideration of removing this tax in the city's.
Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. Are there other folks that would like to testify one way or the other on Senate File 2211? Senator Senjum, I'd like to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Is there any objection to that from members? If not, the chair will lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Senator Bach, do you want to talk about St. Louis County
And then, folks, I'm going to move to Senate File 2246 after that, and the last bill will be Senate File 2136. And we're going to do our best to be done before 11 o'clock. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1914. I don't know the exact history of the interest penalty by counties for delinquent property taxpayers, but it was last enacted or modified in 1991. The lending rate was pretty high back then, probably double digits. And counties then were told delinquent property taxpayers was, rather than somehow being linked to the prime lending rate, was set at a minimum of 10%. And a maximum of 14%. And that's what the current law is. And counties don't have any flexibility on that. So St. Louis County, as a result of the recession, is experiencing a larger number of forfeitures of property. And the high interest penalty that property owners have to pay is a contributing factor, making it very difficult for property owners in distress to be able to get caught up and maintain ownership of the property. So what they suggested to me is in the bill, and it sets the rate between 4% and 7% rather than between 10% and 2%, where it's currently. The prime lending rate today is about 3.5%.
They're good.
This is a change. Something else the committee might want to consider, and I don't often talk about the other body, but the other body, they considered an amendment to this bill that actually set the rate at just 2% above prime. So whatever the prime is, that would be determined, I think, in October, and then under current law, and then the rate that would be applicable would be a rate 2% above prime. And there's an amendment that the committee has relative to that. I'm agnostic to what we do relative to whether we just that are in the bill, or we actually make it a moving number pegged to the prime. This is kind of up to the chair. I'd like you to consider putting some kind of additional flexibility into for counties in terms of the act. With that, I'm sure I'm here to speak to St. Louis. This is a statewide policy, but St. Louis County is the one I think that's raising it on behalf of others. And I don't know how others feel.
Senator Bach, about your idea about the amendment, I know that when it comes to liability, municipalities pay 4% plus, as 4% floor tied to the Treasury rate. And that was an amendment that they made to a bill a couple of years ago about what they thought was fair. It would seem to me that the delinquency rate might follow that too, and some consistency in interest rates that we charge around here would be welcome. I'm thinking, Mr. Ungaro, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. John Ungaro, Government Relations Director for St. Louis County. I would just like to direct your attention to the chart and graphs that were handed to you, or should have been in your packets. They show a very disturbing trend in St. Louis County. As far as our projections for the number of forfeitures that will occur and the amount of assessed value, on the backside of that shows the county will lose as a result of the projections that are currently in place based on the current level of delinquent property in St. Louis County. So we are very supportive of this legislation as a means to hopefully bend the curve on these very disturbing rapid increases. For example, it would be about a 500% increase in the amount of tax forfeited property if nothing is done in the next few years to mollify that, because what happens once a property is delinquent after the first year, certainly by the second year, when you're paying double-digit penalty and interest, and that interest is compounding, it just becomes too overwhelming for the property tax payer who's delinquent to be able to catch up. And so We don't see this as necessarily a panacea, but we see this as at least an opportunity to give that property taxpayer, that property owner, some hope that they can pay back their back taxes and not have to come up with an extra arm and leg in order to do so.
I'm concerned, though, there is a local impact to this. I mean, there would be less revenue for cities, counties, and school districts that otherwise would benefit from the penalty. Is that correct, Senator Bach?
Madam Chair, that could be true, but you also have to look at it. If the property does eventually then go forfeit, then everybody's out of that revenue. So I think this is something. Obviously, the state set a policy back in 1990 tying this to the prime, and that hasn't been adjusted since 1990. The prime in 1990, as Senator Bach said, was about 10%. Today it's 3.5%. I think it's time to update state policy and bring this back to a reasonable level. It's still a stick towards the property owner, but it's tied to the prime and something that obviously in 1990 we thought was a good policy to have in place.
Ms. McQuaid, can you speak to the revenue note?
Madam Chair and members, the revenue analysis says that there won't be any state general fund impacts. As you mentioned, that there will be an impact at the local level from the reduced rates, but there won't be an impact on the school districts because they still receive the same amount of revenue. What happens is their general education aid is calculated, and then the apportionment that comes from the county from the penalties is deducted off the state education aid. And so when less is deducted off the state education aid, more education aid goes out. And so this bill will have a cost, even though the fiscal note is showing blanks, there is a cost. And the blanks are attributable to an unknown. There was the way the fiscal note was done is that there was a survey of all the counties and only 9 replied, and so there wasn't enough information to suggest what the cost would be. But if you took Olmsted County, who responded to the survey, and extrapolated up to the state, it could cost as much as $13 million. If you took the smallest county and extrapolated it up, it would cost only $542,000. So there's such a huge range, and that's why the fiscal note is blank, but there is still a cost, and that's to the general education aid.
Because the state guarantees the state aid payments, and so if there's less to the school districts because of the reduction in penalty revenue, the state is guaranteeing the balance.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Bach, additional thoughts on that?
No, Madam Chair, I just think it would be helpful to do something to help property owners keep their property and start ratcheting up the penalties by 10% a year and compounding them pretty soon. The property tax burden is double what the taxes would have been after a few years. So.
And the penalty is that great, it makes it almost insurmountable just to survive.
I think there is a pretty strong argument that, and the reason I wanted to mention the amendment, Madam Chair, is I'm agnostic to whether we take it more of a living number or just go between 4 and 7, but if there is going to be a relatively non-controversial bill, I do expect you're going to see the houses carrying the moving standard of 2% above prime. So just wanted the community to be aware of that.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the point of the moving target of 2% above prime, if you do happen to run into that in conference committee or an amendment in this committee, I think perhaps you ought to let it float but cap it at 9% or something, you know, so it doesn't go to 14.
Good advice, Senator Skoy. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, maybe a floor too, so that there can be, you know, 2% above prime, but no less than 4, and that kind of thing, or no less than 4, no more than 9, so that there's some stability, and predictability for the local governments too. I mean, if we get to a prime of 0. Drafted.
The floor of 7 and a cap, or 4 and a cap, 7 and
that's more consistent with the current law. It just makes an adjustment to recognize that the prime is 3.5.
So low.
Which is 10 when this was last talked about.
Right.
Senator Vaughn. Without objection, the chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion in Senate File 1914. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, I'd like to move to Senate File 2246, which is a technical bill. It was work done by committee staff for the House and the Senate, preparing a bill that would eliminate obsolete provisions in our tax code and do some important clarification. So when you read the tax code over the interim, it will read much better, and some repeals and obsolete language and provisions will have been removed. That's Senate File 2246. And I'm wondering if there isn't someone that from staff that could work to introduce that bill. Sylvia?
Certainly, Madam Chair and members. What this bill does is essentially goes through the kind of the economic development chapter and removes language that is obsolete, sunset dates that have since passed. These reference the competitive or otherwise the International Economic Development Zone that was never established that is still in the statute. This also makes reference to some TIF provisions that were pre-1979 that the TIF districts have since been required to be decertified. And what this does is essentially just clean up language that is obsolete and removes references that are no longer applicable.
Thank you. Just one more comment here, Senator Rest. The Department of Economic Development is supportive. They're fine with the changes that we've made relating to that economic development program. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A number of years ago, we tried to recodify for the purpose of streamlining the tax increment financing statutes, and we ran into a buzzsaw because a number of those folks in the consulting community were very leery of changes that may or may not affect districts that were authorized under, you know, certain provisions, particularly if there was even a slight change, and this would be, I guess, by deleting some sections, slight changes in the definition of increment or excess increment or whatever. And maybe that, you know, obviously I haven't read this bill yet, and I am going to look at the TIF provisions, however. But I also would just encourage those that work in this area, besides just the staff, to take a look at those. I look mostly at the TIF provisions, but to take a look at the TIF provisions and to make sure that it doesn't place in jeopardy any particular language that they have relied on in their financing and dealing with bond counsel and all that sort of thing. But just a request.
Senator,
maybe when it was being developed, folks like Mr. Casserly, et cetera, were involved in the discussion over it, but I certainly would welcome their comment on it, even if for most of us it seems to be highly technical.
Senator Rest, I appreciate that. This bill was noticed for hearing for Tuesday, so it's been around for a while. There's no surprise here, and I have not heard anything about this bill from anybody. But I am open to any comments, yeah, concerns, questions, suggestions. There is a small amendment, the A1 amendment, that I'd like to offer at this time. And if council would introduce the amendment. Mr. Sylvia.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What this amendment does is on page 25, line 14, the bill omitted the word city after border, and what this is referenced to is the border city economic development zones are the only remaining zones left in the economic development zone. area, and then also on page 36, line 15, in reference to the tax increment finance adjustment to original net tax capacity. This was the same change that was made in the market value cleanup, and it just specifies when the adjustment is made, and this references that it only applies to exclusions that reduced taxable market value beginning with taxes payable in 2012 and thereafter.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvia. I would appreciate the courtesy of the adoption of the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A1 is adopted. And Senator Michelle, I'm hoping that you would make a motion to send this bill directly to the floor. It does not have a fiscal note, and I'm hoping members will use it as a vehicle as necessary for further work of the tax committee if there are agreements. So,
Madam Chair, are you going to ask if there's any testimony?
Is there anyone here that would like to testify for or against Senate File 2246? Senator, or Ms. Pollack, did you have further comments on this bill?
Madam Chair, no.
Madam Chair, Crickets. I'd make that motion then to move this to the floor.
Thank you. Senator Michelle moves that Senate File 2246 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no. The Senate File 2246 is recommended to pass. Thank you, members. Now, we have a little bit more work in front of us today. It's Senate File 2136, and this is the Department of Revenue's technical bill. We did have their policy bill earlier in the week. But Senate File 2136 is a technical bill, and we have quite a few folks from the Department of Revenue staff that are here to help us understand what's being proposed. Ms. Von Mosch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I mentioned yesterday, the technical bill, like the policy bill, came up through the agency with ideas that were generated from staff within the agency. It is very much a technical bill in that it does contain recommendations that are focused on housekeeping type corrections.
Madam Chair, is there a summary of it?
Excuse me, Ms. Mosh. Yes, Senator Rest, the revenue estimate or note is the summary of the bill.
It looks at repeals
hang
of
on,
obsolete.
Ms. Mosh. Do you have it, Senator Rest? If you look at the Minnesota revenue note.
I don't have it, I don't think. But look through here.
We'll make sure you get copies.
Thank you. Now I have it.
Everyone have a copy now? Thank you. Ms. Von Mosch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the provisions in this bill are generally housekeeping technical provisions that look at cross-reference changes, repeals of obsolete, outdated, or confusing language. And we will start today with Ms. Jenny Ryan doing the first two articles on the corporate taxes and the estate taxes.
Thank you. Ms. Ryan, welcome back.
My name is Jenny Ryan. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue, and I'll begin with Article 1. Sections 1, 8, and 9 move the definitions of the definition of field audit to the definitions section of Chapter 289A and clarifies that a field audit is completed at the later of either an order of assessment or notification from the department that no change to the taxpayer's return will be made. Some taxpayers are currently in administrative appeals arguing that a field audit ends as soon as the department's auditor physically leaves the taxpayer's place of business. Since 1991, this has not been the department's understanding of current law. This law change clarifies longstanding department practice and understanding of current law. Sections 1, 8, and 9 are effective the day following final and act.
Ms. Ryan, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but this provision did draw quite a bit of controversy, and the A2 amendment, I'd like to offer that at this point, so members have it in front of them. I will be moving to eliminate what have become, in my view, controversial issues. This is one of them. And if you would hand out the A2 amendment, you'll see that the A2 on line 1.2 deletes the language and audit that includes on page 1, line 28, and page 2, line 2, everything after the period, and deletes lines 3 and 4. So that's the A2 amendment. I'll move to adopt the A2 later. But I just want to make sure folks know, as the department is presenting this bill, that there is an amendment that will be offered on that provision. Members, that would then restore the definition of field audit to what is current law. Ms. Ryan.
Madam Chair, I haven't had a chance to study this amendment, but just initially, it does look to me like this would mean that the department, when starting a field audit, it could be read to require that the department stay physically at a taxpayer's place of business indefinitely until the audit is complete. And what I hear from auditors is that taxpayers generally prefer that we not be in their place of business unless our presence is essential. So usually in a field audit, we would go out to a taxpayer's place of business, have a meeting, maybe take a tour of a place of business, maybe collect records that the taxpayer has prepared for us. And then if there are additional documents that need to be collected, additional discussions that need to take place at the taxpayer's place of business, our auditor would leave and would not return until the taxpayer was ready. This could be read to mean that our auditor needs to show up every day and wait until a taxpayer is ready to complete the field audit. And so it could be read as a change of what the department understands current law to be.
Ms. Ryan, if you want to proceed, and then we can take up the amendment and hear further testimony, questions, or comments about that after a further introduction of the bill.
Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 make technical changes to clarify the provisions for estimated tax payments in Section 289A26 that applies to both C corporations and entities that pay unrelated business income tax. This is just clarifying that those provisions apply to both types of taxpayers. Sections 6, 7, 8, and 10 are all related provisions regarding the requirement that taxpayers report federal tax changes to the department. In sum, these provisions clarify the following. The taxpayers are required to report to the commissioner within 180 days of a federal tax change. Taxpayers who do not report within the 180-day period are subject to a 10% penalty of the amount of any underpayment of Minnesota tax attributable to the federal change, and that the department can reassess the tax, including a refund, within the shorter of 6 years after the report should have been filed or 1 year after the taxpayer files the report, notwithstanding any general statute of limitations to the contrary. And finally, if the department has completed a field audit prior to the federal change, then the department's changes are limited to those necessarily flowing from the federal change. These sections are also effective the day following final enactment. Sections 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15 all work to repeal obsolete references to the Internal Revenue Code. Section 16 clarifies that the net operating loss reflects both Minnesota business losses and Minnesota non-business losses. Section 17 clarifies the department's longstanding interpretation of Section 290.17 Subdivision 4 that for combined reporting purposes, the more than 50% common ownership test applies only to related C corporations. This is a point of confusion and disagreement for some taxpayers, including an administrative appeal and a case in tax court. Again, this amendment clarifies the department's longstanding interpretation of this section and is effective the day following final enactment. That concludes Article 1.
Members, I just wanted to let you know that Section 16 is one that we will consider in the amendment when we take that up. Ms. Ryan, I think you also had the estate tax provisions.
Yes, I'll go on to Article 2. All of Article 2 relates to the recapture tax, which is part of the estate tax exclusion that passed during the last special session. The language that passed in the previous section included a provision in Chapter 291 that imposes a recapture tax payment due 6 months after a disqualifying cessation of the trade or business, or disqualifying disposition of the property. So while imposing a payment due date, the language that passed also assumes that there's a filing requirement and a filing due date. We've moved those administrative positions from Chapter 291 to their appropriate places in Chapter 289A. That's what occurs in Section 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Section 2 proposes an annual information return requirement during the three-year period after decedent's death to help the department confirm that no disqualifying cessation or dispositions have occurred. That concludes Article 2.
Thank you, Ms. Ryan. And we also have Mr. Storica back. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lance Storica with the Department of Revenue. I'm here to...
Sir, I'm going to ask you to speak up. We are having, maybe it's just me, but I'm having a hard time hearing the testifiers today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lance Storica with the Department of Revenue, here to explain Articles 2 and, Articles 3 and 4. Article 3 has to do with the property tax. Sections 1, 5, 7, 8, and 12 have to do with applications for property tax, homesteads, and classifications. Three things are going on. One is that newly required tax return information is being protected from disclosure, made private or non-public. Number two, some obsolete language related to mailing homestead applications is being eliminated. This relates back to when that annual mailing ended in 1993. And third, associated cross-references are corrected. Sections 2 and 4 have to do with licensed appraisers doing non-tax-related appraisals, and simply adds the allowance for them to do appraisals for government land exchanges. Section 3 allows commissioner to abate late payment penalties for the air flight property tax. Sections 4 and 9 have to do with use taxation, where tax-exempt property is made available or leased to a taxable entity. There's a tax. Case, there's a definition of what tax-exempt means. In one case, property of the federal government is left off the list from the state, local, and so forth. And the other list of local use is left off the list. Section 3 clarifies for the electrical co-op for capture tax, which applies in rural areas and lieu of property tax that are institutionalized from statutory city from incorporated areas to statutory home charter. Section 11 has the list. Need to be changed. Doing is striking the word for verbatim instruction in the statute and inserting a paragraph. Kind of what subdivision 2 already provides. Section 13 has to do with the senior citizens property tax deferral program. This allows our lien notices to be more consistent with the lien notices that we issue for other taxes by eliminating a notarization and statement requirement. The repealer is Section 15. It repeals two things. One is it requires people who lease tangible property to file a list of all items to the commissioner each year. We haven't done this. The second thing being repealed is now obsolete exclusion when property owner took action to reduce lead paint hazards. That's Article 3. Article 4 has three sections. The first section has to do with the deed tax. It provides a definition that relates to a longstanding exemption for deeds that do partitions. Clearly and narrowly specifies what those are to match. Section 2 has to do with the retaliatory insurance provisions and strikes a reference to a provision that was repealed in 2005 and adds a reference to a provision that was enacted in 2000. Strikes a reference to a provision that was repealed in 2006 and adds a reference to a provision that was moved to a different subdivision. And Section 3 has to do with certain purpose statements that were included in last year's tax bill. The department is nitpicking over a couple of words in those purpose statements. The first one has to do with grinding materials in minerals production. Those things are for tax purposes, materials consumed in the production of a product. They're not, we don't treat them as equipment. And the second one has to do with ticket resellers, and technically for tax purposes, we don't have an exemption. The one reseller gets a credit for the tax, the other reseller or the other seller paid, but there's not really an exemption for either one of them. And that concludes Article 4.
Mr. Strick, while you're there, Article 3, Section 6 is one that the department has asked us to eliminate from the bill. Is that correct, Ms. Von Mosch?
Madam Chair, yes, in the House there was some discussion about this item and a lack of comfort, I guess I would maybe say. And in our effort to keep the department bills as non-controversial as possible, we agreed to remove Section 6, Article 3, Section 6 from the bill.
Right, and members, that's included in the A2 amendment, so we'll get back to all three of those items in the A2 amendment when we're done with the presentation on the bill. Senator Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Von Mosch, can you just speak to what the concern was on that particular provision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, I believe it dealt with the fact, I think it was the whole premise of the provision that the grain had to be owned by the person whose homestead it was, and there was some concern that perhaps there would be someone who would be storing grain on a rental basis. I believe that's right. I might defer to Mr. Sturica to embellish that explanation.
Are there comments, Mr. Sturica?
Not really. I think that captured the essence of what the concern was.
Again, members, the goal is to take out any section here that is controversial. We're trying to pass along a bill that is technical in nature and that will assist them in getting their work done between now and the time we return. We're up to the minerals tax. Mr. Krenkel, welcome.
Yes, my name is Stephen Krenkel. I'm testifying on Article 5, minerals tax. These amendments relate to the amendments to the taxes imposed on ores, metals, and minerals other than iron ore last year. The first section of the article deletes the term direct reduced ore. The reason is that the direct reduced ore is an iron ore. The exemptions only apply to those persons subject to the non-ferrous taxes, so by definition, the exemption cannot include direct reduced ore. Direct reduced ore is already exempt under the iron mining provisions of the chapter. So the exemption is not deleted, just an inappropriate reference. The second section is hydrometallurgical process. It was a new term in the statute last year. It's not a defined term. We used a Bureau of Mines dictionary as a standard definition reference point to supply a definition that was simply omitted. The third section is conforming the distribution sections. The tax is now imposed on ores, metals, or minerals. This amendment simply conforms the distribution section to the imposition section so that the same subjects are treated.
Thank you, Mr. Krenkel. And then we have the miscellaneous tax, and we have Ms. Morrow.
Yes, my name is Cecilia Morrow. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Section 1 of Article 6 relates to state warrants in general. It's included in the department's technical bill as it affects the department, but the issue is also relevant to all state agencies that issue warrants. Thus, the department's advancing the proposal on behalf of itself as well as MMB. Section 1 amends Section 1646 of the statutes to clarify the consequences of a warrant being canceled and made void by spelling out that when a duplicate state warrant has been issued, that the original warrant, which is specified as void under the statute, means that any holder of the void warrant may not recover on the void warrant as against the state. Sections 2 through 12 of Article 6 amends the revenue statutes that direct how interest on penalties is calculated in order to simplify the statutes and make them more uniform. Each of the statutes affected by those sections is amended to provide that interest runs on the rule stated in the General Tax Administration Statute, Chapter 270C, in which 270C 40 sub 3 provides that interest runs from the date a penalty is assessable until it is paid. That concludes Article 6 and the end of the bill.
Thank you. Murrow, questions or comments from the Department of Revenue on their technical bill? Ms. Van Mosch?
Madam Chair, thank you for hearing the technical bill. I was just looking at some of the provisions in the A2 amendment. See what they affect. Excuse me for a minute.
Maybe it would help if council introduced the three issues in the A2. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, the three issues in the amendment. The first issue is on lines 1.2 to 1.4 of the amendment. And those three lines deal with the definition of the audit, Madam Chair, that you referenced earlier. The second part of the amendment is on lines 1.5 and 1.6, and those deal with issues having to do with net operating loss carryovers. And the third issue is on line 1.7, and that's deleting section 6 of on page 31 of Article 3.
And that's the Class 2B priority.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Ms. Van Mosch?
Madam Chair, the department is, would agree with you in terms of deleting Article 1, Section 16, and Article 3, Section 6.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Michelle.
Ms. Van Mosch, I don't think you were referencing the pieces of the A2 that you're trying to. Want to try that again?
Yes. It was just pointed out to me that there is just one line that is being deleted, and we are okay with that one line being deleted.
Ms. Van Mosch, with respect to which of the three provisions?
I'm sorry. Article 1, Section 16, lines 19.13 and 19.32.
That's lines 1.5 and 1.6 of the A2 amendment. You're saying you have no problem with that?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
And I'm assuming, too, that you're agreeable, as you testified just previously, with the reference on 1.7, deleting page 31, section 6.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So you want to, at this point, you want to speak to the first change?
Madam Chair, I think we'd have some concerns about the first change because it would change our department operating procedures for how we conduct field audits. I would want to go back and talk with our audit managers about this, but I think it could have some large implications for the use of staff resources. And so we would have some concerns about that change. As the provision was proposed in the technical amendment, it was a clarifying change that was trying to codify our existing practice, and I believe now that the way it is being amended would change our existing practice.
Are there folks here that would like to speak to the A2 amendment, in particular to the field audit provisions? Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We certainly support the amendment in that first section on the definition of field audit for just a couple of reasons. First, the taxpayer protections that were put in place about 20 years ago, this is what it kind of deals with, is what's the definition of field audit, and when can the department come out and look at the books, so to speak, of a company. And at least some practitioners believe that the as initially drafted, that erodes some of the protections that were put in place 20 years ago. They feel that this provision could encourage the department to delay issuing an audit report once they find out a taxpayer is under a federal audit, because once the federal audit is determined, the audit stays open for, in some cases, numerous years and decades. So the concern is, what's the interaction between a state field audit and when they determine if the taxpayer is also under federal audit? Also, I'd just like to draw your attention to lines 6.23 to 6.29, and that's where the current definition of field audit is in the statutes. And the amendment that's being proposed just really basically puts back the existing law into a definition section of the field audit. So the existing law does not have anything about an audit that includes, so expanding what the scope of an audit is, and it also does not have that last sentence, the field audit is completed at the later of sentence. So at least in our view, if this is purely supposed to be a technical change, those two provisions that are deleted in your amendment should be eliminated. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Von Mosch or Ms. Ryan? Ms. Van Mosch?
Madam Chair, I would like to suggest perhaps that we be given either some time to go back to the agency and study the amendment, or that we would recommend just taking out the Section 1 of Article.
Ms. Von Mosch, I would suggest that this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion for a bill that would be rolled out on Tuesday. And so I'm hopeful, noticed tomorrow, though. So I'm hoping that if we adopt the A2 amendment, then you will work with Mr. Hesse and with our staff to clarify and maybe make other changes that everyone is agreeable to accomplish the goal here, which is to maintain current law. I think that's what everyone wants to do. I don't think anybody, I know the department may want to make some changes here, but I think folks would feel comfortable that it's a technical bill if it maintains current law.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that. But that is our goal, is to maintain current law and current department practices.
Mr. Hesse?
Madam Chair, and I agree. We think this bill ought to maintain current law.
Madam Chair, then
Senator Michelle,
given your discussion and the timing over the next couple days and week, I would move the A2.
Thank you. Anyone else like to speak either for or against the A2 amendment? Questions or comments from members? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A2 is adopted, and the Chair would like to lay over for possible inclusion Senate File 2136 as amended. Members, we will post the schedule on Friday. The goal is to roll out the second omnibus tax bill, which should be relatively non-controversial. It's got the policy bill, the technical bill. It's got some of the local option sales taxes that we've heard since we passed the first omnibus bill. It's my expectation that this may be the last bill out of the committee. And we will pass it on Tuesday with any amendments. I would ask folks to please be prepared with amendments on Tuesday morning so we can process that bill and finish it up. And that may well be the last committee meeting for this session. With no further business, we are adjourned.
Thank you.